Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know how this machine worked.
Hey, that's mine.
You son of a...
Hey, take those headphones off right now!
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 210, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's topic is the cosmic Marvel Universe, which we are seeing for the first time really coming up in this weekend's Guardians of the Galaxy.
They call themselves the Guardians of the Galaxy.
What a bunch of a-holes.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me. I'm hooked on a feeling.
And here to talk about this very timely subject, no pun intended with Marvel and timely, haha, is Jim Yelton. Now, before I bring Jim on, let me explain. Jim and I have just done a show, but it probably will air after this. So it's going to be more confusing to us probably than to you, the listener. So you don't have to worry about it again. But Jim, welcome back aboard the White Rocket.
Thanks, man.
Since this will be the first time people have heard from you in a little while, and you're now clearly my most visiting guest, tell the folks out there who you are and what you do.
I'm a writer. I publish through my own company, Midnight Entertainment, which you can find at midnight-entertainment.com. We just posted a preview of our upcoming superhero series, Extraordinary. You can also check out our big science fiction action adventure galaxy-spanning epic, The Swindlers of Doom, which kind of is in our wheelhouse for today's conversation. I also write and direct for the stage, and I'm a screenwriter and teach screenwriting classes. So I pretty much do a little bit of everything.
Absolutely, and all very cool. So, yeah, this is a good time to be bringing up this topic, the cosmic side of the Marvel Universe.
Why is that?
Because
is there something going on with the cosmic universe in Marvel?
There's a certain motion picture with a certain furry raccoon creature and his companions that's about to come out, and I can't wait. It's the most anticipated movie that I for me since probably Avengers, and I'm really, really excited about it because I love the cosmic Marvel Universe. And for those out there that don't exactly know what we're talking about, Marvel has... You know, in the greater Marvel universe, there are all sorts of subsets of characters and settings, right? I mean, there's the Spider-Man world, which is like downtown New York City, and the Daily Bugle, and the places that Spider-Man and Peter Parker usually go. You know, there's the Fantastic Four with the Baxter Building and their thing. There's Atlantis with Namor, the Submariner, and all that. What do you call the Khazar and the Antarctica and the dinosaurs?
Oh, the Savage Land.
There's all these different sort of locales. But one big chunk of the Marvel Universe is what they generally just sort of call the cosmic part of the Marvel Universe, where you have basically all the outer space sort of sci-fi and mystical kind of stuff going on. And there's a certain set of characters and comic book series and miniseries and events that figure very heavily in the cosmic side of the Marvel Universe. What we're going to do is we're going to kind of walk through some of those and explore them and talk about them a little bit and how they all kind of figure into maybe what Marvel's going to be doing with movies. But before we do that, I read two interesting interviews yesterday, and one of them was with, I believe, Kevin Feige, the head of Marvel Studios, and he basically, you know, people have been asking him, you know, what made you want to go into this part of the Marvel Universe in movies? And he's like, well, because all the other movies are so similar in the sense that it's always kind of, I guess Thor is a little different, but otherwise it's, you know, it's usually New York City, it's modern day Earth, you know. But if they can get the cosmic Marvel Universe rolling, there's just no limit to the places they can go in the movies, the things they can do. They can have aliens and cosmic beings like Galactus and Thanos, and I don't know if they can use Galactus, but you know what I mean, Korvac or the Collector, and there's just so, you know, the Nova Corps, there's just so much they can do if they can successfully bring the cosmic part of the Marvel Universe into movies. How do you kind of see that, Jim?
Yeah, I think he's right, because the one thing Marvel has done better than, say, DC and Warner Brothers trying to roll out the DC characters is the plan has never deviated from being safe, but also kind of expanding what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when they did Iron Man, it was because Iron Man, they felt, was the most accessible of the characters they had available to them, because it was basically just a guy getting into a suit and being a superhero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had the armor, and everybody can kind of buy into that concept. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, to do Thor and Captain America was kind of getting a little bit more fantastical. But even Captain America isn't going outside the norm all that much. And Thor, they decided to ground by not just doing the Asgardian stuff, but bringing him to Earth and,
yeah,
and doing the Jane Foster stuff and really kind of grounding it in a little bit more reality. Plus, Thor has the added benefit of all of the conflict Thor has is with Loki. And that's a very, you know, sibling rivalry sort of thing. And
yeah,
everybody kind of gets family issues. So, you know, once you get beyond the Asgardian fantastical stuff, Thor is still very grounded.
Mm-hmm.
Guardians of the Galaxy for me was Marvel saying, okay, we need to do something and see how far we can stretch the boundaries. And nobody outside of hardcore comic book fans know who the Guardians of the Galaxy is.
Right.
All of these characters are fairly unknown to the general populace. And it's going to the furthest reaches of the Marvel Universe. So it's not grounded in anything that's familiar to the general audience. And I think their general feeling was, if we can have a hit with this,
yeah,
then we can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
We can do Doctor Strange. We can do Black Panther. You know, we can get more street level and do like the Daredevil. We can do the Punisher or whatever. But if we can go as crazy fantastical as we is and do it, that kind of opens the door up for everything.
Yeah.
And I think that they're doing it at the right time, because they had the big hits with all the solo movies. They had the huge hit with the Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
So even though this is kind of a stretch for them, it's still kind of safe, because they built the Marvel brand before they decided to just go crazy with, oh, well, we're just going to start doing all sorts of characters nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah, there's been such a careful plan. It's just amazing how much thought and care is going into this, as opposed to like the superhero movies of Marvel stuff anytime up until basically Iron Man, which was just, hey, let's try this. Hey, let's just throw this out there and see what happens, you know. This just, they've got this very carefully well thought out plan that crosses years and years and many different properties. And it's really a joy to behold how the plan is coming together, right?
Well, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit later on after we go through more of the buildup and the history of that side of the Marvel Universe. But they're really smart with the characters that they're using,
mm-hmm,
in this movie. And, you know, I think that this could be, I don't want to say that it's going to be as big as the Avengers, but, you know, we've certainly not had, you know, a huge blockbuster crowd-pleasing movie this summer. And I think people have been waiting for this kind of movie. It just seems,
yes,
fun.
Yes, absolutely.
And I know you, absolutely, and I have talked about the Avengers after it was released. And that was the one thing coming out of the Avengers. I was like, man, it was a great movie. And, you know, the performances were great and the story was great. And I loved everything they did, but it just seemed fun.
Oh, yeah.
Like, by the end of the movie, I was just glad to have gone to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just a great experience. And I think that that's kind of the tone they've got with this, too. I mean, I just, everything I've seen, all the clips and the trailers and everything, it just seems like it's going to be a fun ride of a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that they asked Feige in that interview I thought was interesting was, you know, are you, if, you know, if Guardians of the Galaxy is a hit, will you do like this cosmic character? And he basically said, if Guardians of the Galaxy is a hit, that will be the vehicle through which we do most any other cosmic things we want to do. So I took that to mean if there's, you know, that they already have greenlit Guardians of the Galaxy 2 as of this,
yeah,
of our taping. And it could have Warlock, you know, or it could have Mar-Vell, or it could have Ms. Marvel, or it could have some other. In other words, if they're going to bring some of those other big characters in, it would be in a Guardians of the Galaxy movie, at least to start with. And it's funny because it means they're kind of doing it backwards from how they did the Avengers.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, it's smart in a way because Guardians of the Galaxy then becomes your umbrella sort of title for anything that would be have that cosmic bent to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 could very easily be, you know, the Annihilation event.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start bringing, you know, another handful of new characters into it. And I think Marvel's got this attitude with all their movies where they don't care if it's called Captain America. They don't care if it's the Avengers or Ant-Man or Iron Man 4. If they decide that they want to put two or three new characters into it, that's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of like that. I mean, I think they might run into some trouble of eventually having too many characters in it, but it's kind of like, you know, when I sat through Captain America the Winter Soldier, I loved all the characters that they had in that.
Oh yeah.
I
loved it. It was like a mini Avengers movie.
You know, and they didn't need to explain to me why Black Widow was there.
No.
Or, you know, introducing the Falcon. And I love the idea that the Falcon can be in any other Marvel movie now.
Yeah.
It doesn't just have to be a Captain America movie. Like, he can show up anywhere. And I think that's kind of how they feel about it, is Guardians of the Galaxy 2, the fact that they're doing a second one blows my mind, because it blows my mind that they're doing a first one to begin with.
Yeah. But that's the best thing.
The fact that this first one introduces the Nova Corps, it introduces, you know, nowhere as a place, and, you know, all of these characters, you know, we're going to get a real hardcore look at the Kree and, mm-hmm, you know, some of the other alien races. So it's wide open. I mean, it, you know, having the Kree version of Captain Marvel is a possibility.
Yeah.
And it's a very real possibility, you know? I mean, it's not like something that, oh, well, wouldn't it be great if they did this?
Oh, gosh.
It's possible that they're going to do that somewhere down the road. They have to.
I have my blue fingers crossed. Well, let's dig through some of the history of Marvel cosmic stuff and sort of talk about what it is and how it might could figure into the future of the movies a little bit, but mainly just on its own merits as just great stuff that's been done. I've kind of divided up the sort of three eras of cosmic Marvel. The first era, the 60s and 70s, was the stuff that mainly came out of what Stan Lee and Jack Kirby were doing in the Fantastic Four, because they didn't mind bringing cosmic stuff into the pages of Fantastic Four. You got the Skrulls, the alien race there. You got Silver Surfer and Galactus in the famous 48, 49, 50, the Watcher. You know, so a lot of the foundations of the cosmic Marvel universe were laid down by Stan and Jack in the early Fantastic Four.
Yeah, and I've had conversations with you know, some of my collaborators on some of my stuff, and you know, we getting ready to do a superhero series myself, and I know you've probably thought about this a lot doing the Sentinels. Mm. You know, when you think about what they did early on with Marvel, hindsight, it looks like there was a plan. It looks like they had this grand idea for this unified, you know, universe that all these characters were in. But I really think a lot of it was haphazard.
Oh, yeah.
It was just, we want to tell these stories.
Yeah.
We like the idea of a Galactus. We like the idea of these race of shapeshifters called the Skrulls and that sort of thing. And I think it wasn't until later when other writers came in and started picking up some of those threads that it really became more than what I think Stan and Jack even planned. I mean, I know Jack Kirby was big into doing the big sprawling cosmic epics, but I don't think he ever could have imagined something like what they've done with the characters here recently.
Right. No, I mean, the thing that's about Marvel Universe in general that's fascinating to me is it really is like this giant shared creator universe, and whether they give all those creators proper credit and payments, a whole other issue that we won't go down. But but it really is this giant shared thing where you get what we have today is a result of just dozens and dozens of creative people over decades, each laying down their own contributions, taking things in different directions, making different connections and spinoffs. And it's funny to me that one of the side effects of that is that you get multiple versions of the same thing a lot of the time. I mean, if you took the Marvel Universe and dumped it all out, you know, like Legos or something on the floor, you'd have a lot of duplicates. You know, in other words, they've done something, and then another writer and artist have come along 10 years later and done basically the same thing slightly differently. And so you get a lot of duplication, but it really makes for this enormously rich environment and sandbox to play in.
I think where Marvel has been at its best is when they've had creators come along that have said, you know, hey, what Stan and Jack did with Galactus and the Silver Surfer was really cool. That kind of opened a doorway. I want to go in this direction with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to rehash what they did. I don't want to tell another Galactus is going to come to Earth and, you know, consume it. I want to tell this story using those characters and maybe expand it a little bit. And they've been really lucky that they've had guys come along like Jim Starlin.
Oh, yeah. About to get
Jim. Just really opened it up.
Yeah.
And said, hey, I don't want to tell stories about superheroes on Earth. I want to go tell these stories.
Yeah.
And they let him.
Well, that's a big part of this sort of the 60s, 70s stuff. I'm going to throw out a few things here and we can kind of dig around in them from that period. I mean, we're talking about the Guardians of the Galaxy. There was the original Guardians of the Galaxy, which was, you know, Starhawk and Yondu and Martin X and Charlie 27 and
Vance Astro.
Nikki.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was a cool team, but I a lot of my friends are complaining that that's not who is in the movie. And I always have to point out they haven't been the Guardians of the Galaxy in a number of years. And it's not like Marvel's going to go, hey, let's do a contemporary movie and use characters that haven't been the Guardians of the Galaxy for a long time and just ignore the ones we're currently selling in the stores. So, of course, the movie has the Abnett Lanning, you know, revamp version, which I like I like both. I'm happy either way. So you had the early Guardians of the Galaxy with some really interesting cosmic adventures. The Badoon came in, the aliens. Jim Starlin came to Marvel somewhere in there. And the stuff that he did with probably the two heroic characters that he's best known for, Warlock and Captain Marvel, or as we've kind of retroactively started calling him Captain Mar-Vell to distinguish him from all the other, you know, Captain Marvels that are running around. I like to call him Captain Marvel because for me, he is Captain Marvel. This is the blonde headed pink Kree, right? Whose book ran, I think, something like 52 issues, somewhere along 48, 49, 50, something along those 53 issues, somewhere in there. And was actually the last original major character that Stan Lee created was Captain Marvel, Mar-Vell. But Warlock was really Jim Starlin. And of course, the classic villain that Starling created back then to go along with it all was Thanos. And of course, Thanos now is going to be, is, has sort of turned out to be the major villain behind the scenes of almost all the Marvel movies to this point, which blows my mind, by the way.
Yeah, how crazy is that?
And so when DC finally tries to do Darkseid, everybody will be like, oh, he's totally ripping off Thanos. Because for those that don't know, Thanos has always been accused of being a ripoff of Darkseid. But see, Thanos is going to be a major movie figure before Darkseid ever gets out of the cartoons. So I just, as a Marvel guy, I kind of think that's funny. But, you know, I'm just, anyway. Yeah. So that kind of gets through the 60s. There was, we got to mention a couple of things. What Starlin did with Captain Marvel was come onto a book that was really struggling to find a purpose. You know, he was an alien on Earth that could fly and hit people. Who does that sound like? An alien in red and blue who flies and hits people. I can't think who that could be. And so Starlin said, let's stop making him Superman and make him more cosmic. Because if you want to describe what Jim Starlin does to his stories, capital letters MORCOSMIC, more cosmic, to use the, you know, Twitter parlance. And so he took Mar-Vell and sent him off into space and gave him cosmic awareness and these photon blasts and really made him a completely different character that I just loved. And more about him in a minute, because in the late 70s, you get a good run of his last run of Captain Marvel. But I think it was really with Warlock that Starlin did what's endured for him. It's like Starlin took a whole lot of drugs that were popular in the 60s and then wrote Warlock. Has that always been your impression?
Yeah, well, and the funny thing is, looking back at those stories from like the late 60s, early to mid, you know, it does seem like they are very much of the time. Like, those stories would not have been told if somebody had tried to write them today.
No way.
I mean, there's a lot of introspection, a lot of, you know, characters trying to figure out their place in the galaxy and deal with who they are and what they are. And, you know, there's a lot of people trying to bring peace to a warlike galaxy sort of a thing. And, you know, I always think that you're right, that, you know, there were drugs involved at some point in the creation of some of those characters and stories.
It got very trippy too, in a kind of a Steve Ditko, Doctor Strange way. You know, a lot of the stuff, because Starlin was drawing as well as writing his stuff, and it looked like a superhero. You know, Doctor Strange is a superhero, but he's like the least superhero-y of the superheroes to me. He's more something else. You know, to me, Doctor Strange is to superheroes like Gandalf is to the warriors of Middle Earth. You know, he's fighting the battle, but in a different way, right? And so you get a lot of that vibe with Warlock, that he's kind of a superhero, but he's kind of like a holy man, a lunatic, a mystical character all at the same time. His greatest enemy is himself in the future.
Yeah,
his greatest ally is Thanos. I mean, there's just so many amazing and cool and crazy ideas that run through all of that. So,
well, and I think you hit on something else that was just starting to happen at that time too, and that's that he did the artwork and was writing it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of had the same guy creating the whole thing. And the only people he was answering to were the editors.
Yeah. Yeah. It wouldn't have been the same if he had been trying to get some artist to draw the stuff that he's doing.
There was not a collaboration with somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, cause I think the same thing, a lot of the time about Steranko and the stuff he did with Nick Fury.
Yeah.
Because it was very much his vision. And I think with Starlin and all the cosmic stuff, you know, for whatever reason, he just kind of latched on to some of these ideas that he wanted to put on paper. And, you know, he didn't have 18 different layers of collaborators trying to talk him out of doing some of the really out there epic stuff that he was doing.
Yeah, that's a good point. So Thanos came along during this time. He appeared originally in an Iron Man issue, but got bigger and more important kind of very quickly. And I want to mention the two big the two big Thanos stories early on that kind of established him as a major, major league Marvel villain. First, he showed up in a storyline that kind of involved the Avengers, but was really more, about Captain Marvel, where Thanos got the cosmic cube and was aging everybody. And all the superheroes are aging and dying, and at the end, Captain Marvel is able to find the cosmic cube and chop it with his super cosmic karate chop, which sends Thanos kind of everybody back to normal and Thanos to the center of the universe or something, where he's later rescued. That kind of rolled later over into what is my all-time single favorite comic book story ever, and is the one that really gets the ball rolling on everything that we know about Thanos since then. His love for death and his lust for the Infinity Gems. And that all comes out of the Avengers Annual number 7 and Marvel 2-in-1 Annual number 2 from the summer of 1977. Jim, the summer of 1977 was an awesome, awesome time to be alive and young in the United States of America.
I know, because, I mean, you could go down to the local convenience store or the grocery store and find a spinner rack. And I mean, you'd be able to pick up some of the coolest stories in a comic. You could go to the theater and watch Star Wars. Yeah. You could go home and sit in front of your TV and watch some really cool shows.
I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. So
kids today don't know what they were missing.
They don't know. That's right. And there was nothing to compete with it. And there were no DVD players or anything like that. So you got your one thing and you really enjoyed it because it was your thing that you had. It's amazing. Avengers Annual number 7, basically, I'm going to run through this because this is a really important story. Avengers Annual number 7, Thanos has acquired a bunch of the Infinity Gems, and rather than making a gauntlet out of it yet, he hadn't figured that out yet. Instead, he makes a big gun that he's going to actually fly around in his giant spaceship and blow up every star in the universe or the galaxy or whatever. It varies. To make Death happy because he's fallen in love with the personification of Death. And you get some nice flashbacks to him basically nuking Titan or whatever and all this stuff. Because he's the other son of Mentor and the brother of Eros. Boy, I tell you, where all the gumption in that family, all the genes went on one side of that sibling rivalry. So he does all, he fights the Avengers and defeats them and takes them captive and is getting ready to blow up the sun at the end of Avengers Annual number 7. And he even kills Adam Warlock. And then in Marvel 2-in-1 Annual number 2, Spider-Man gets a mental message from Moondragon and that this is all going on. And Spidey's like, well, I'm Spider-Man. How am I going to do anything about this? I need to go over and get the Fantastic Four. But of course, the Fantastic Four are mostly not home, except the Thing is there. And so the Thing listens to Spidey's story and somehow believes him. And they fly off into space and rescue the Avengers. And there's a huge battle. And the synthetic Infinity Gem that blows up stars is blown up. And ultimately, Spidey, we discover that Spidey's entire purpose for existence, which I love, is that Jim Starlin revealed the number one reason that there is a Spider-Man is so he can knock over the glass globe that imprisoned the Soul Gem, where Adam Warlock has been absorbed into the Soul Gem that he used to wear. And Warlock pops out of the Soul Gem on fire and naked, basically, and turns Thanos to stone. And then basically goes back into the Soul Gem where he lives out the rest of his days, we thought, in happiness with his former enemies whose souls he's devoured with it, and also with Gamora and Pip the Troll, his companions. And so that was a great ending to the whole Thanos Warlock story, but they didn't end there. They keep bringing it back. Now, what's your reaction to that whole bit?
Well, and I always thought that, looking back on it now as an adult, that to me was always one of the coolest things about the Marvel Universe was, you know, you just went through the basic bullet points of that whole story sequence. And how many different comics did that appear in?
Two.
It wasn't like it was... It wasn't spread out over, you know, a 12-issue miniseries.
It would take 30 today.
Right. And it it didn't tie into 18 other monthly titles.
Nope, one story. It
was two issues. And I think we've talked about this before, where, you know, that was one of the great things about that period of time in comics. But also, just the sheer kind of oddball pairings of characters that they had. You know, the Marvel 2-in-1 is the one that always gets me, because it's Spider-Man and the Thing.
Yeah.
It's like, I always wondered, did Starlin just sit down and have like a bunch of names in a hat? And he was like, okay, well, I know it's Marvel 2-in-1, so it's got to be the Thing.
Yeah.
And who's he going to team up with? Okay, we'll just pull a name out of a hat.
Yeah.
Oh, Spider-Man. Okay.
Works for me. Yeah.
And I love, I have not ever read that whole issue, but I love the cover, because I think, if I'm thinking right, that's the one with, like, Thanos is on the cover, like, holding Spider-Man above his head.
Yes.
Like, he's getting ready to break him in two. And I'm like, okay, what is Spider-Man going to do against that guy?
Nothing.
Nothing.
He hides. In fact, that's what's funny is when Thanos is mopping up the floor with the Thing and Thor and Iron Man, everybody, Spidey's like, I'm getting out of here. He goes and hides.
And like you said, I mean, the best part of it is knowing that he has to be there to knock something over.
Yeah.
Like, it has nothing to do with his abilities. It has nothing to do with him being Spider-Man. He's just clumsy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He, in fact, when he's rescuing the Avengers the first time, he's going to, like, go through the machinery that's keeping them in stasis. And he's like, where's something big and heavy lying around I can use? Ah, what the heck? And he just jumps into it himself like a bowling ball and smashes his body into it. So,
And that was also, like, that 70s Spider-Man was also kind of like my favorite version of Spider-Man.
Oh, because yeah.
He had not yet had all of the big epic Spider-Man adventures yet. You know, he was still like the Spider-Man that whenever he would get into that big cosmic situation, you know, whether it was with the Fantastic Four or the Avengers or whoever, you know, he was kind of like, okay, I'm out of my element here. I just want to go back to New York.
I'll go hang out with Daredevil and we'll watch this on the news tonight.
Right, exactly.
I'm going to hit a couple of things quickly as we move along. The Kree-Skrull War was a little earlier on. It was in the early 70s, and I think it's cosmic in a way, but it's really just more outer space. It's not really beyond, you know, it's not really mystical or whatever in the way that the Starlin stuff was kind of mystical and outer spacey both. But it is very important because you get this giant. It's like the first big company sized, even though it wasn't really a crossover company. It's the focus of the company on this big event that ran through numerous issues of the Avengers, where the Kree and the Skrull basically fight a war, and Rick Jones is involved, and Rick would always be involved in the cosmic stuff. Also, in the mid-70s, we get Nova, and I was arguing this with somebody the other day. The original Nova, the 1970s, Rich Rider, he was not really a cosmic character in his own book until maybe the very end of its roughly 20 issue run. But,
yeah, you're right.
Because Nova was basically Peter Parker as a Green Lantern instead of Spider-Man.
Yeah, and I always, from the very beginning, and we'll kind of talk about this as we get closer to some of the rebooted stuff, like, that's how I always looked at Nova. Like, I always felt like there was somebody at Marvel, or else there was a meeting or something, and it was just kind of thrown out there, like, you know what, we need our own Green Lantern Corps.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we need that kind of, you know, cosmic police force sort of thing. We're going to be doing these cosmic stories. There should be somebody out there kind of like that.
But they really didn't incorporate him much in this.
Exactly.
The early Nova stories, it was just very much like Spider. He's fighting, like, you know, muggers and the Yellow Claw or something. And it's just that he happens to have this suit and this power. I've always said he really had more in common with the Greatest American Hero than he did with Green Lantern or the cosmic stuff for a while, because he had a cool suit and powers and could fly and didn't know how to use his powers and just kind of flew around on Earth doing stuff and saying blue blazes a lot. So Nova becomes important and more cosmic later on, and you get to see the whole Nova Corps. But early on, he really was just kind of an attempt to do another Spider-Man, I thought.
But I think, and this is where we'll touch on it later, I think the 60s and 70s was a lot of these really cool concepts that nobody really knew what to do with.
Mm-hmm.
Starlin, you know, the genius of Starlin is that he had a whole story he wanted to tell.
Yeah.
And, you know, it took him telling the story in various different titles and in various different ways, but he kind of had a through line for some of these characters he created. And, you know, it didn't matter to him how he told the story as long as he got to tell the story. And I think once he got the story told, nobody else really knew what to do with some of these characters and concepts, which is why they kind of just kind of languished out there in the Marvel Universe, not being used for years.
Yeah, and later on, people come along that really have done some cool stuff. And they all come back at least two or three times after their original. I'm going to throw out a few more from the 60s and 70s, and we can kind of just like sift through them real quickly. We would be remiss if we didn't mention Jack Kirby coming back to Marvel and creating the Eternals and the Celestials. Now, we just got through talking about, for an upcoming episode, Battlestar Galactica, and how it talked in the 70s was kind of influenced by the sort of the Eric Von Daniken Chariots of the Gods kind of aliens from outer space who helped the Incas and the Aztecs and all. And the Eternals were very much Jack Kirby being influenced by that thinking, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's really overt, too. It's not like he was trying to like keep anything secretive about where the influence for that was. Yeah. I mean, it was very – and again, that's very much of the time where – there was a lot of discussion going on about, well, why do the pyramids look this way and how could they have been built if people didn't have help from, you know, some extraterrestrial overlord or something. And, you know, the idea that we have all been seeded by some alien race was very big back then.
And interestingly, the Eternals have never really been that big in Marvel since then. They pop up here and there, but they've never really been popular. But the Celestials, who were just sort of these giant beings that the Eternals dealt with, they were kind of like the ones doing the seeding around the universe, around the galaxy, whatever. The Celestials have popped up probably more often than the Eternals because they're such a neat idea. They're basically a bunch of Galactuses that are even more enigmatic, even more mysterious than Galactus, and there's a bunch of them. And the, you know, and their heads look like giant coffee mugs upside down and stuff. And so they, I've always just found the Celestials to be fascinating.
Yeah, because it's kind of like the, I had the same vibe watching early Babylon 5 with the Vorlons.
Oh yeah,
that you know, there was this race that was bigger than us.
Mm-hmm.
Not size wise, but just, you know, power wise, and that they had been around forever and they did things that we as mortal man were not meant to understand.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't need to know why they were doing it. They were doing it.
In all capital letters, man was not meant to know.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, that's kind of how I've always felt about the Celestials, too. It's just like whenever somebody brings them up, they're doing things and, you know, we may not understand why they're doing them. You know, but there's a purpose and they've got a bigger plan and, you know, it's just the way they are.
There was a great Thor run toward the late 200s of Thor where he dealt with the Celestials and the Eternals and stuff. And it was fantastic. I think Roy Thomas wrote it. We got to mention Korvac. The Avengers dealt with Korvac, the Collector, Karina. There was a really beautiful run in the 160s, 170s, up through 177 of Avengers. And I've always felt like Korvac would have been a great cosmic character along the lines of Galactus or the Celestials or Thanos, but they've never really brought him back. So I guess once you've done his story once, you just really can't – there's nothing else to do with him.
No, because that was – and you'll appreciate this because the second issue of Avengers I got ever
–
was a back issue that I bought that was the end of the Korvac saga.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, that's like watching the last episode of Babylon 5 of season four.
Right. And, you know, I'd been reading comics for a couple of years up to that point and, you know, was sticking with the more kid-friendly stuff. But the thing that drew me to that one issue was it had so many characters in it.
Yeah, and they all died.
But it's, you know, it's got the Avengers, you know, a really strong group of Avengers, that late 70s Avengers team.
Oh, yeah.
Where it was, you know, who was it? It was Cap and Iron Man and Thor and
Wonder Man and the Vision, Scarlet
Witch. Wonder Man and the Vision and Scarlet Witch and Beast, and so it was a really hardcore group.
Yeah.
And then you had the Guardians of the Galaxy thrown in there because they were all teaming up to fight Korvac.
Now, we have to say, that story doesn't work nearly as well if it's the current Guardians of the Galaxy.
No. And
which is kind of what they tried to, do on the animated series, and I thought it didn't really work that well. You know, the Avengers Earth Mightiest Heroes, they did a one episode 30-minute Korvac story, and I'm like, okay, you can't do Korvac in 30 minutes, and you sure can't do it with Rocket Raccoon and Groot.
No.
You need like the 70s old school Guardians for that story to really work, because it's a story of emotion and pathos and loss and self-sacrifice and all that kind of good stuff. It was just an amazing story by Jim Shooter and a cast of many artists, including Wetzel and Perez. If you're going to go back and read, if folks out there, the stuff we're talking about now, this is just fantastic stuff. There's a really awesome, I mentioned this earlier, the last great hurrah of Mar-Vell, in his own book and then in Marvel Spotlight 1, 2, and 3, I think, where Doug Minch and Pat Broderick were doing it. And this was the run of Captain Marvel where he meets Elysius, right? His wife or girlfriend or whatever, the mother of Phyla and Genus. And he teams up with Drax the Destroyer when he was small and purple and green and had energy blasts and a big cape. I like that version the best.
Yeah.
The enemy was Isaac, who was the computer of Titan, the Titan's world, moon of Saturn. They had a planet-wide computer called Isaac that was a benign intelligence, but somehow like Thanos' programming got into it, and Isaac became this evil HAL 9000 computer thing. And Eros was in it, Mentor was in it, Rick Jones, you know. It's just, and the art is fantastic. If you can track that down, I don't know if they've ever reprinted it, but like Captain Marvel number 57 or 58 through maybe 62, and then that's where it got canceled, was 62, I believe. And then the first two or three issues of Marvel Spotlight finished the story out with the same creative team. It's just so good. That's just a great, great story.
There are a lot of stories towards the end of the 70s like that. It was really clear that the creators had like one really good story to tell.
Yeah.
And, you know, they didn't need four or five issues to tell it. They could tell it in two or three and get in and get out. And they were taking chances as far as like, you know, killing characters off left and right. And, you know, I know it's comics and, you know, they'll figure out a way to bring somebody back at the drop of a hat. But, mm-hmm. you know, some of the characters that they would kill off, it was like, you know, soul crushing when they would kill off a character.
Well, speaking of which, that brings us to the end of this little segment, which of Cosmic Marvel, which is the 70s, 60s and 70s, which really was about, I think, 1982. This was crushing to me because I thought they had really found a good formula for Mar-Vell with what Munch and Broderick were doing. And then they gave it all back over to Jim Starlin and said, go ahead and kill him and give him a good death. And I'm just like, no, because he was my second favorite character after Iron Man. And they gave him freaking cancer and killed him.
Yeah,
it was well done, that graphic novel. I've still got my copy in the basement somewhere. It was original from then, but it was well done. But I didn't want to see him die. And gosh, Bucky has come back. You know, Phoenix has come back. But man, Mar-Vell is in the same place in heaven as Uncle Ben, apparently. He ain't never coming back. He is dead, dead, dead. He's Uncle Ben dead.
You know, at this point in time, I don't even know that Uncle Ben dead at this point. But I, looking back on it, I understand why they did it, because, you know, wasn't that was the first Marvel graphic novel.
It was.
And I think they wanted something that was going to like really hammer people and, you know, really be a big kind of a thing for that format. And, you know, what could be bigger than killing off one of your main characters in the entire universe? And you know they're not going to kill off Captain America or Spider-Man or, you know, any of, you know, there was probably a handful of characters that were untouchable. But knowing that Jim Starlin could tell a really good story in that format, I think it was something that they couldn't pass up. And they were kind of like, well, if we're going to do it, let's do it this way.
Yeah, well, better him than anybody else. I will go along with that. But still, I just felt like he was a great character and had more that he could have done. I wanted to see him in the Avengers as a regular member. That would have been awesome. But and interesting, I think he'd have been interesting chemistry with, like, Wanda, you know, Scarlet Witch, for example. But anyway, there's that great bit where she's falling when they beam back from the collector's station. And she's in midair and is falling, and he zooms down and catches her. I think it's Wanda. And she's like, how did you know? And he says, to one to whom a feather falling in the desert is a loud sound, your plight was nothing, you know, because he's got cosmic awareness, you know. Well,
and that was the other thing. Like, I think he was getting to the point where I don't want to say he was too powerful, but, you know, it's hard when you get a character that's got that much ability and superpowers.
Yeah,
it's hard to write for that character and think of things for them to do where they aren't going to overshadow everybody else in the story. I mean, I think it's interesting when you said, you know, you would have liked to have seen him in the Avengers. I just don't know how that works. Like, he's at the point where they killed him off, he was almost more powerful than Superman as far as, you know, what he could do and, you know, the power cosmic and everything. So what other choice did they have but then to do that one last dramatic story where they kill him off?
Yeah, I guess. But I don't know. I just think he's a good character. And I if I had been older, I would have given them a whole lot of story ideas. I would love to have written Mar-Vell. Ms. Marvel came along during that time too, and I'm only going to mention her very briefly. She's probably my third favorite character. This is Carol Danvers. She popped up originally as like an Air Force pilot and then later got her own book as Ms. Marvel and was like a magazine editor, and just they did some really strange things with her over the years, but she'll always be Ms. Marvel to me, in the black costume with the little sash, kind of the Phoenix design, you know, the Dave Cockrum design. She pops up again later as we go. So let's jump on to the 80s and 90s and kind of – I'm just going to throw this bucket out there and we'll do this kind of quickly because it's all really one big thing. In the 80s and early 90s, start really in particular, late 80s, early 90s, Marvel basically said, hey, Jim Starlin, write a bunch of cosmic stuff with Thanos and just use whoever you want. And so there was the Infinity Gauntlet, the Infinity War, the Infinity Crusade – the Infinity trip to the gas station, the Infinity stops at McDonald's, and then it spun out into Warlock and the Infinity Watch. And I want to just kind of touch on that stuff all together briefly. And also, because of that, you start getting Thanos everywhere. He became like Dr. Doom at that point.
Yeah,
he's popping up in everybody's book. In fact, and I'll jump ahead a little bit with this, you start seeing Thanos as the villain in Pet Avengers. He popped up in Kazar. I mean, what? You'd have been embarrassed to see Dr. Doom popping up. So
think about where Marvel was at that period of time, though, and where the industry was. So they were very willing to kind of turn the keys over to Jim Starlin,
yeah,
because he had the name cachet. Mm-hmm. And that part of the Marvel universe was very easy for them to say, well, go do whatever you want.
That's true.
So
Quasar too was in there. I failed to mention him.
Yeah. So
for all you Quasar fans, sorry to leave him out.
You know, he could do all that, you know, seemingly never ending run of different miniseries, and it really didn't affect the core Marvel universe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, you can send characters off into space to hang out with Warlock or hang out with the Nova Corps or whatever, and they're just sort of off the radar. In fact, that's kind of what they did with Quasar for a while. They just sort of sent him off into space to do his thing there. Now, I was never a big Quasar fan because he came along in kind of the mid-80s when I wasn't really reading comics. And so when I came back in the early 90s, I'm like, who's this Quasar dude and why is he – I thought this was Marvel Boy. What's going on? Who, you know, what's the deal? So, so really quickly, your overall view of the Infinity – miniseries is
well, I mean, I liked the first one or two that they did.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was kind of cool to see Jim Starlin doing that big cosmic epic kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then after the first two, I kind of felt like you did when you were doing the introduction to those. If it's just going to keep being miniseries after miniseries, why aren't you doing this as a regular series? Why aren't you kind of expanding some of these characters in their own titles? It just seemed like they weren't really having an impact on the greater Marvel universe like some of the earlier stuff did. And, you know, if it's just going to be kind of like this tangential thing you're doing, then I don't really care if Thanos gets all of the Infinity Gems. I mean, it's not impacting 90% of your universe. And, you know, even when they would bring in some of the bigger, more well-known Marvel characters to participate in those storylines.
Which they certainly did.
Like it was and they did, but it just seemed like it was a sidebar thing. It wasn't as big of a deal as, you know, like Secret Wars. Some of the other stuff. I mean, it just seemed like they were doing it because the speculation market in comics was starting to pick up. They were just trying to flood the market with more titles and get as much product out there as they could.
Now that you mention that, I hadn't thought of this before, but now that you say that, it makes me really think that a lot of the Infinity stuff with Thanos felt like Jim Starlin's take on Korvac, where you got this villain who gets uber powerful and everybody tries to stop him and he kills everybody, except that Thanos had actual, you know, motivations maybe a little deeper than Korvac. Korvac really didn't know what he was doing other than just, I can be God, so I will. Whereas Thanos is like, I can be God, so I can get with this chick Death, you know. They had different motivations, but really it ends up with the same thing. The one thing you kind of do get, though, with the Infinity stuff is you get Warlock and the Silver Surfer having a bigger role than, you know, they didn't really have a role in Korvac. And so with the Infinity stuff, you got to see Warlock as kind of a planner and strategy guy, kind of the cosmic Captain America to a degree.
Yeah.
And you got to see the Silver Surfer as like the ultimate cosmic agent of action that can go places and get things done in a hurry. So it was kind of neat, I thought, how those characters got highlighted while basically the others all kind of stand around and wait for a chance to punch something or blast something, you know. So, well... Any other thoughts about the Infinity period before we... I don't want to give it short shrift, but really, I mean, it's kind of the same thing. It's Thanos wants to take over everything or kill everything or something to impress Death, and everybody teams up against him. You get some really cool scenes with, like, Galactus fighting him or the Celestials or Zeus or something, and that's awesome. I love it. But, I mean, that's pretty much it, right? So,
well, and that's why I said, I mean, it felt like after... You know, the first series or two, the rest of the miniseries they did were just kind of being repetitive. It was like, how many times are we going to see this play out with different combinations of characters trying to stop Thanos?
Yeah.
And, you know, we all know at some point he's not going to succeed or else the entire universe would end. So, you know, I've always felt like, what's the point of telling that story more than one time?
Yeah. No, I get it. It is neat. I mean, there's stuff that's neat about it. I'm glad I read all the Infinity stuff more or less, but you know, that's probably enough. Lastly, the Annihilation event kind of re-jump started, if that's a way of putting it, the Marvel Cosmic Universe a few years ago, just of recently. I mean, when did Annihilation come out? Somewhere like,
I want to say like 05, 06.
Yeah, somewhere around the same time as maybe Civil War was about to happen or something. I mean, it was like the big cosmic thing while the Earth heroes were doing their big thing, you know?
Yeah.
And they were kind of concurrent. And Annihilation, the problem I had with Annihilation was twofold. One, I just never took Annihilus that seriously as a villain or a threat. I think of Annihilus as the dude that flaps around in the negative zone while Reed Richards, without any powers, holds him off with a flaming bone. I'm not making that up. That actually happened in one of my first Fantastic Four issues I ever bought. So when he's suddenly basically Thanos light, I'm just like, what? The Nova Corps is getting knocked to pieces by Annihilus? Seriously? The other problem I had with Annihilation was that it was utterly mind-numbingly grass, watching the grass grow and the paint dry, boring. I thought the original Annihilation event, almost in its entirety, was utterly dull. I just didn't care. It brought all these really cool characters into action, and they just were boring.
Well, because at its heart, it has one big thing that's going to happen, and that's Annihilus and his Annihilation Wave taking out the rest of the galaxy, and Annihilus being the ruler. So basically what your entire series is leading up to is that big battle at the end. And you can only drag out the prelude to that battle so long.
And did we need...
You have to have the battle.
And plus all the spinoffs, all the limited series. I mean, you know, like I said, a couple of them were good, but most of them were just pointless. I mean, I think there was maybe a Nova that came out of this, maybe a Silver Surfer one. The others are just forgettable, utterly, utterly forgettable. So I'm just going to forget them. Now, like a year or two later, though, and I forgive me if I'm wrong about this, but do we not blame all that on, wasn't that Keith Giffen mainly?
What are we blaming Keith Giffen for?
Annihilation, writing of it.
Was that not Abnett?
No, bite your tongue, young man. Bite your tongue. How dare you?
Oh, yeah, you're right. The first one was Keith Giffen.
Yeah, it was terrible. So Marvel made the very, very brilliant decision when they decided to do a follow-up called Annihilation Conquest, which doesn't make any sense unless you understand it basically should have just been called Conquest. It had nothing to do with Annihilation, except that it was the next big cosmic thing. It's like if it had been happened a few years earlier, it would have been called Infinity Conquest. You know, I mean,
they just tacked
that name on. But Annihilation Conquest was everything. It was the polar opposite of Annihilation. Everything about Annihilation Conquest was awesome and epic. I loved it. It was Abnett and Lanning. My listeners may know I'm a huge Dan Abnett fan anyway for his Warhammer novels and other stuff. I just thought this was fantastic. The villain here turns out to be an Avengers-related villain as opposed to stupid Annihilus. He brings in some cosmic stuff as well. You get the Guardians of the Galaxy started back up new. The Nova Corps is involved, but they're actually interesting this time. You know, you get the Warlock and Phyla Vell, whatever she was calling herself at the time, maybe Quasar, I forget. She changed every 3 weeks. But it just had a lot of really great characters. It was very well done. It had a great all the supporting comics that went with it actually contributed and were interesting pretty much this time around, including what's the dude in the armor that was such a lame Avenger and new warrior, but he was actually, they even gave him a good miniseries here. Darkhawk.
Oh yeah. Darkhawk. Yeah.
Darkhawk even had a really good series and ends up like assassinating Lilandra or something.
Well, cause they actually came up with really cool backstory for him.
Yeah.
And the armor and everything. So it wasn't like he was just a lame armored hero anymore.
Yeah. Oh, it was great. And it ends with bringing in the Shi'ar and Gladiator, who I think is one of the more interesting underused characters in Cosmic Marvel. He got a great, I'm going to spin this on into the next thing that came out of it besides the new Guardians of the Galaxy ongoing and the new Nova series, which were both excellent. That you also got War of Kings that came out of this, which included the Inhumans and the Kree, their connection to each other. The X-Men were kind of involved. Ronan was involved in it. Just all kinds of good stuff came out of that. The Guardians of the Galaxy were right in the middle of it. So I thoroughly recommend going back and if you haven't and reading everybody out there reading Annihilation Conquest, Guardians of the Galaxy, Nova, War of Kings. Every bit of that was just fantastic. It was really the last big thing in comics that I really enjoyed to this very day. So
Well, I think what happened was Abnett and Lanning, one, all of that's in their wheelhouse.
Yes.
Like, they're really good at writing that kind of science fictional story as opposed to a more superhero-y sort of a thing.
That's right.
But I think what happened was, after the first Annihilation series, when... Because I think they did the Nova series was spin off of Annihilation. And then the editors went to them and said, do you want to do the follow-up to Annihilation? And they were like, well, yeah, why wouldn't we?
Hmm.
And it was kind of like taking the training wheels off for those guys.
Yeah.
Because they were given the task of basically plotting that whole follow-up series. And to have Marvel say, we're going to give you this corner of the Marvel universe that we really don't care about.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have anything to do with Earth Marvel.
No.
And it doesn't have anything to do with Spider-Man or the X-Men or the Avengers.
Or Civil War, any of the stuff that they're putting
on. Yeah, any of the stuff that we really think is important. So you could pretty much do whatever you want with the cosmic stuff.
Oh, man. Wouldn't you like to have been Abnett or Lanning at that point?
Yeah, I think that's why that stuff was really good, because then they were able to do what guys had done in the 60s and 70s and say, well, what's the big story we want to tell?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't even have to be contained to this one series. Like, we'll write another series next year and follow up. So they started looking at it as acts of a play almost,
yeah,
where they said, okay, act one is going to be Conquest and act two is going to be this. And then we're going to do War of Kings. And, you know, what do we want to do after that? And how are we going to go down the road with these big events? And I think they're smart enough that they figured out how to do the big event series and make all of the surrounding, you know, monthly tie-ins work for that instead of, you know, the other way around.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But I think you're right. Like, how cool would it be to have somebody say, well, here's a bunch of characters we don't really care about.
And it'd be those.
You want with them.
And it'd be the ones that are so cool, right? And they just were neglecting them, not even using them. So,
well, because, you know, that's what it was. Like, especially, you know, with some of the stuff that was spun out of Conquest, like the Guardians of the Galaxy, where they took a concept that was kind of cool in its original incarnation, but let's not use those characters. Let's take Star-Lord and revamp him. Let's do a revamped version of Drax the Destroyer. You know, let's use Rocket Raccoon, who's been kind of a jokey footnote in the Marvel universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's use Gamora, let's use Groot, and make them a really cool team.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's such an improbable team. I mean, you know, if you read some of Abnett's Warhammer stuff, he's very good at bringing these sort of diverse teams together, and, you know, from his Gaunt's Ghost little army guys to his Inquisitor's team of agents that work for the Inquisitor. He's always bringing together these groups of agents with different abilities, and so it makes sense that he would be very good, and Lanning, you know, is sort of his co-plotter, at coming up with this sort of at making that work. So we've kind of gotten to the end of what I have as far as individual items to talk about. Is there any other cosmic stuff that you want to mention that I have left out?
No, I mean, I think we've touched on everything. I just think it always amazes me how expansive the Marvel universe has become over the years. And, you know, when you think about the breadth of it, and, you know, it's not just all the heroes in New York. It's, you know, these kind of like galaxy spanning adventures. And I mean, just the sheer number of different alien species that have like these huge empires. And, it, you know, the really cool thing about some of the good cosmic stuff that's come over the last, you know, 10 years or so is that you get to see like these huge empires battling each other. And, you know, whether it's, you know, Abnett and Lanning or other people that are helping them, they do a really good job of showing the big epic scope of the situation, but also how's it affecting individual people in the story, and how does, you know, a small group of people impact the bigger picture sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, let's bring it then back full circle to the movies, and we'll kind of close with this. What out of all this stuff that we've covered that hasn't been in the movies, since we're going to have the Collector showing up now in Guardians of the Galaxy, we're going to have the current Guardians team, we're going to have the Nova Corps, we're going to have Thanos. What other thing do you really kind of hope they can find a way to squeeze into the movies anytime soon?
Man, I don't know. I mean, it's the, you know, you're not the only person that I've talked to about this. Mm-hmm. And it seems like now we're in a situation where, you know, it's not just, wouldn't it be cool if they did this in a movie? It's, wow, like, we're really close to having the Kree and the Shi'ar fight each other.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I don't even know if it would be the Shi'ar, because I don't know who owns the Shi'ar at this point, if that's an X-Men thing or if that's a Marvel thing. But, you know, clearly we've got the Chitauri. We've got the Kree. You know, they can introduce a couple of more alien species that could go at it. I mean, you know, there's talk about them doing the Inhumans as, you know, a movie down the road. And if they do the Inhumans, then you're kind of setting up War of Kings, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing I keep thinking to myself when I look at Marvel's schedule, where, you know, they've got movies planned for the next 10 years, or at least dates that they want to hit for releasing movies. And I think to myself, well, there's only so many Avengers movies that they're going to be able to do.
Yeah.
And there's only so many Iron Man and Captain America and Thor. They're going to have to do new movies. So what's Guardians of the Galaxy 3 going to be?
Yeah.
I mean, let alone 2, but like, they're going to tell a third one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if these movies are successful, and what isn't that going to be War of Kings? I mean, isn't that where they're going?
I would have originally said there's no way, but honestly, I didn't dream they'd ever even use Thanos, much less make him the architect of the bad guy, you know, all the bad stuff. So,
well, and that's my thing, is Guardians of the Galaxy 3 is most likely going to be scheduled after the third Avengers movie, which everybody seems to think that the third Avengers movie
Thanos
will be Thanos and some version of the Infinity Gauntlet,
which
is mind blowing to think about that. But then if you've told that story, what else is there for you to tell that's going to be a bigger story than that?
That's true.
And what are the Guardians of the Galaxy going to do? So it's just, it boggles my mind sometimes to think about some of the stuff that they could have down the road.
I think I would want, more than anything, I want to see Mar-Vell and maybe Ms. Marvel, but I don't know if we'll ever see it. That superhero may have sailed.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we're going to have a Carol Danvers version of Ms. Marvel, Captain Marvel.
Yeah. Yeah.
At some point down the road. I mean, I'd love it if they did Captain Marvel, the Mar-Vell version, and I just don't know that that's doable, but there was a Kree in the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the TV show. I mean,
that's crazy.
And they're going to have Kree in the Guardians of the Galaxy. So anything's possible at this point.
Yeah, it's amazing. I guess the only other thing I'd like is Warlock, but he's probably the most complicated and hard to do as a movie of all. I'm not putting anything past him, but I'm not holding out a lot of hope for that, but we'll see. All right, well, we're about out of time. Jim, thanks for coming on and digging into the great history of Marvel Cosmic and maybe what they're going to do within the movies in the days and years to come. I follow the White Rocket in the future. We've got lots more episodes coming up this year with some more cool topics. In fact, the one that Jim and I just recorded before this, it'll be coming up in a week or so, which will be about the original Battlestar Galactica, which is a lot of fun. So, Jim, thanks so much for coming on today, man.
Thanks.
All right, and we'll see you all down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
I'm Groot.
This might not be the best idea.